funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the emphasis on good manners come to occupy such a central position in English culture? And what influence do those standards of behavior have on the rest of the English-speaking world? Here in the U.S., we tend to think of the English as inherently better behaved than we are. But imagining that we live in a time and place where manners have never been worse turns out to have a long and geographically diverse history. Author Henry Hitchings is here to talk about that and about the origins of English manners and the particular paradoxes they entail. His new book is called Sorry, The English and Their Manners. Henry, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Start us off with this. What is the difference between manners and etiquette?
Well, it's quite a big question. The way I would tend to think about it is by defining what etiquette is. Etiquette is a set of what one might call cosmetic codes, superficial details, some of which can seem very significant, but to do with essentially external things like what kind of knife we use to eat fish or what size a greetings card should be. Manners is a question of underlying principles to do with attitudes. Once upon a time, the two were bound up, but in the 19th century, when etiquette guides became prevalent, so a lot of people began to think that actually manners meant etiquette, this sort of veneer of performance details. The word etiquette wasn't in common use, indeed, until the 19th century. It was imported into English from French in the mid to late 18th century by the Earl of Chesterfield, who was a great sort of arbiter of behavior. And the moment the word etiquette started circulating, it kind of pushed manners as a word to one side. And it seems to me that one of the issues is that manners has a kind of image problem, because when you hear the word manners, what a lot of people immediately think of is actually these points of etiquette. Like, you know, how long you should mourn for the passing of your cousin and stuff like that, rather than about fundamental principles to do with how we should treat other people.
So if I pick up my salad fork and eat my dinner with it, it may be a breach of etiquette, but it doesn't mean that I don't care about the company that I'm with or that I won't pay attention to their conversation and be a good hostess.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's fair to say that if you know which fork you are, as it were, supposed to use, and you deliberately flout that, you're doing something which is maybe a little bit obnoxious. But, I mean, in terms of fundamental principles, it's just not that important which fork we use. I think that the people who attach a lot of significance to etiquette would argue that it's with that basic control of our personal space and our deportment that we advertise our sort of finer feelings and better qualities. But the reality, as I'm sure most listeners have experienced, is that you encounter people who have wonderfully high standards of etiquette, but really quite terrible fundamental values, and people whose fundamental values are very good, who probably wouldn't know what a salad fork was.
Of course, sometimes it can be confusing to tell the difference. You open the book with what struck you at the time as a sort of terrible violation of manners by the American tennis player John McEnroe at Wimbledon in the late 70s. Tell us about this temper tantrum that he had and how you have come to view it subsequently.
Well, what it really was to do with is that when I was a child, I watched a lot of tennis with my parents sitting on the sofa at home. And John McEnroe's great rival was the Swedish player Bjorn Borg. And they would always sort of come together at Wimbledon and have these wonderful tussles. And McEnroe was this, you know, tremendously demonstrative person. If he had a thought, he certainly gave vent to it. Borg, by contrast, was almost machine-like. He didn't really betray any emotion whatsoever. And I can remember my parents saying to me, perhaps it was a little bit more oblique than saying to me, but indicating to me that Borg was the model of sportsmanship and sort of elegance and decorous comportment, and that McEnroe was basically a kind of thug and a yob. And at the time, you know, under the parents, obviously, one of the sections of society who play a very large role in establishing people's ideas of manners. And so I rather bought into that. But later I came to think that actually there was something about Borg's kind of erosion or erasure of his personality that was faintly sinister. And while there were aspects of McEnroe's kind of sort of hypersensitive, brattish squealing and squalling that weren't particularly savoury. There was a certain kind of truthfulness to himself in that. And I think one of the things which has happened since the 1970s, the sort of McEnroe heyday, is that the prevailing view of society has shifted. I'm not necessarily saying this is a good thing, but the McEnroe-like behaviors where self-expression is paramount now really seems the norm and indeed is widely encouraged. And the Borg, rather kind of pent up, not really showing any emotion, is seen as a sign of terrible repression rather than as a mark of sort of elegance and dignity.
Which is so such an interesting observation, because it seems that self-control has always been a central feature of good manners. Very often we've simplified them to say that they're about doing not what comes naturally to us in many aspects.
I think there's something in that. I mean, one of the ways I think about manners is that they exist to keep our raw primal urges at bay. And as we all know, a lot of those primal urges are pretty unpleasant. I mean, if you look at early guides to manners, and when I say early, and I'm thinking about English language ones here, one's talking about sort of 14th and 15th century, there's a real emphasis on sort of means of curbing violence or sort of diffusing the possibility for violence. And the guides to manners that existed in that period were written for aristocratic young men who were supposed to read up on this stuff, mainly before participating in social occasions such as feasts. And one of the things that happened at a sort of medieval banquet was obviously there were a lot of knives in circulation. There were also diplomatic occasions when you would be encountering people who you might actually have some kind of natural hostility towards. And so there was great potential for violence. I mean, this is no joke. And the codes of manners existed essentially to sort of create barriers and prevent there being that violence. And I think one of the things you could say is that as society has become less violent on average, I mean, there are still atrocious acts of violence all the time, but the average level of society, whatever the media may suggest to the contrary, is less violent now than 500 or indeed 200 years ago. So the manners that we were sort of elevated in order to kind of prevent violence have come to seem less important and have kind of slipped into sort of disrepair. And I think that's kind of dangerous, because if you allow that to happen, naturally the possibility is that the violence will become resurgent.
Yeah, I suppose because we lose that focus on the needs of other people, or we become less sensitive maybe to how our behavior affects others?
I think that's probably true. I mean, I think one of the things about codes of manners is that actually they exist in a way to mean that you don't need to think like that and be sensitive. If you know what the rules are, then you don't need to use your judgment, and the rules tend to come from a pretty good place. The moment you start using your judgment, actually things can get quite kind of dangerous. But of course, there is a sort of fundamental principle of manliness, which is to show respect for other people's possessions and space. And it always seems to me that one of the reasons why manners is a national obsession of the British is because we live in such close proximity to each other. I mean, I should say that I don't think the British or the English are any more polite than anybody else, but there is no question that manners are a national obsession, hence the title of my book, Sorry, the English and Their Manners. And one of the reasons is just that the population, it sounds ridiculous, but the population density of Britain is such that one is in very close contact with other people all the time. And codes of conduct, manners, are necessary in order to sort of, because we're rubbing up against each other, to stop that being explosive. And just to sort of, you know, quantify that, I mean, the population density of Britain is 10 times the population density of the United States. And so you do just spend a lot more time in situations where there is both literally and figuratively friction between people who probably don't know each other.
So rather than, say, throwing down when someone accidentally bumps into you in a supermarket, you say sorry, even if you're not the one who did the bumping.
Exactly. And that's a sort of English malady, you could say, the saying of sorry. I mean, one of my possibly not brilliant witticisms on the subject is that the English are very good for very good at apologizing for things they haven't done, but not very good at apologizing for things they have done. certainly, that use of sorry there is to diffuse a situation. It's a sort of public acknowledgement that something's happened which needs to be stopped right there. It's not actually an apology. And it's in the 19th century that people started to say sorry rather than I am sorry. And the word, the adjective sorry, was being sort of unmoored or untethered from the person feeling it, and it began to be used really as a piece of, almost as a piece of punctuation rather than an expression of sort of genuine sorrowfulness. But one of the things, I mean, I have actually heard the Canadians say sorry a lot, but certainly one of the things that American visitors to Britain tend to notice is this constant use of sorry in quite what to them seem quite incongruous circumstances. And I read a news item in a British newspaper, I think about 3 years ago, which said that the average British person says sorry 8 times a day. And I thought this seemed highly implausible. So in a rather kind of amateurish, anthropological way, I started maintaining a little audit of how much I used the word sorry and how much people used it in my presence. And actually, 8 times a day was a ridiculous lowball. The figure was something more like 15 times a day.
Wow.
I don't know whether it was actually that I was conducting an experiment which made me say sorry more, but it is incredibly sort of pervasive in society in Britain.
Does the overuse of that word take anything away from a genuine apology when you say to someone with whom you have a relationship you care about, I am sorry that I did that?
Well, I think the critical thing in what you just said there was the I am bit, mm-hmm. because it seems to me that you can hollow out any word by using it relentlessly. I mean, I think it's kind of true of profanity as well, just to choose a sort of rather different example. If you curse all the time, it becomes valueless. If you do it very sparingly, then actually it really signals something. And in the same way, the word sorry used constantly becomes almost sort of bleached of meaning. But I am sorry is a much less common thing to say than just sorry. And consequently, I think when you phrase yourself in that way, you are restoring meaning to what is in the normal course of events a rather kind of bleached out word.
How did particular behaviors first start to be codified as acceptable for court in particular?
Well, essentially, there were the medieval guides to conduct, which were aimed at young noblemen and actually were originally written in Latin. And what happened essentially then was that as British society became more mobile, so people started trying to sort of have access to those codes. In order to kind of help project themselves up the social ladder, so to speak. Obviously, the early codes of manners actually precede a society where a lot of people are sort of literate, so they would have been read to their audiences to quite a large degree rather than for private consumption. Then as literacy increases, one of the things that there is demand for is, you know, guides to how to behave yourself, because it's seen as one of the things that's a sort of guarantee of your nobility, is that you understand how to behave yourself in formal situations. And as the middle class in Britain grows, particularly in the 18th century, so these kind of codes become much more widely available, and so too they start to be written not just for a male audience but also for a female audience. I mean, it's a strange quirk of history that there are really no guides to manners for women in Britain until the 18th century. I mean, there were a handful before that, but rather perversely, they're all written by men, so there's a kind of dictatorial quality about things.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is author Henry Hitchings. His new book is called Sorry, The English and Their Manners. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Henry Hitchings. His new book is called Sorry, The English and Their Manners. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. And Henry, before the break, you were saying that the first guides to etiquette for women were, strangely enough, written by men who I suppose had strong opinions about how a well-behaved lady should behave.
And also had more access to literary skills. I mean, they had more access to education rather than to talent. And obviously the people who control the sort of means of production have tremendous power. A more literate female sort of population becomes one where obviously the balance of power in terms of who writes these things changes. And it's fair to say that in the 19th century, in Britain and indeed in America, for the first time, the main target audience for books about manners and etiquette becomes women. And that is something that really, I think, has endured. And it's very noticeable that in America, where there are quite famous arbiters of correct behavior, like Miss Manners and Emily Post, they are women, and I can think of a few others like Amy Vanderbilt, for example, from the past. It's interesting, in Britain we don't really have those sort of public arbiters who are taken seriously and have syndicated columns across lots and lots of print publications. But there's a real sort of power shift in the 19th century towards women being the people who define the territory in terms of correct behavior.
Why do you think that is, given that women were probably historically the least likely to, pull the knives out at a table and start misbehaving? Why has this now fallen mostly to women?
I think it's probably to do just with domestic life. I mean, I'm not here necessarily saying how I think things should be.
No, I understand.
Or anything like that. But, domestic life from the 19th century up to sort of the present has been dominated by the female perspective. I think there's sort of a lot of, it's just really before about 1800, so many women were silenced simply by not having decent education available to them. And so didn't have literacy skills, the ability to read, the ability to write. And that's obviously something that changed with improved education and also the sort of explosion of print culture in the 18th century, just far more printed material out there, the means to self-education, a much sort of more vibrant kind of literary marketplace with books catering for all kinds of needs, including sort of household management and things like that. But really before, let's say certainly the end of the 18th century, women simply didn't have access to the kind of education which enabled them to participate in this conversation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hello, Doug.
Yes, hello, Chris. How are you, and how are you, Mr. Hitchings?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
Very well.
I have a question. It concerns a set of volumes that I've just finished. It's a really good read. It's Douglas Southall Freeman's his biography on Robert E. Lee, an apparently very well-mannered officer. At West Point, he was the class of 1929. He graduated second in his class, but what was interesting in the biography is that they actually listed the grades. He had exemplary grades, but they scored candidates that were all to be future officers on manners and comportment and disposition becoming an officer. And coming at the end of the Napoleonic Age, I actually have two questions for Mr. Hitchings. Did the inclusion of manners at a distinguished institution like West Point, was that the result, do you think, of the Napoleonic influence on military? Of course, Napoleon was defeated just a handful of years prior to that. Or was it perhaps from Britain? And the second question is, have we lost something by not having comportment and manners as an actual graded subject that would judge the fitness of a future officer in the military? I'll take my answer off the line.
Thanks for your call, Doug.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I mean, I'm obviously not an expert on Robert E. Lee or all the protocols of the West Point Academy, but my impression is that the main influence on what would have happened at West Point would actually have been a kind of hangover from British colonial guides to manners, and then really these got sort of Americanized and rewritten, but the whole, particularly after the American Civil War, the whole science of mannerly behavior, of deportment, began to be taken very seriously. And I think this the question about whether it's something that should be a graded subject, the difficult thing for me is exactly how you grade it and how it should sit alongside other subjects. I mean, it could be a sort of pass-fail subject, but the idea of giving someone 77% for deportment, you know, as opposed to, for say, chemistry, seems a little bit sort of pedantic. But it's interesting because schools were, and I'm talking about schools in the broader sense, traditionally one of the places where manners were inculcated. But I think this sort of shift in philosophy, which I alluded to earlier when I was talking about the John McEnroe situation, now I think teachers, I can't say what the situation is in the US, but certainly in Britain, are encouraged to foster, above all, self-expression and freedom of expression. And that rather kind of admonitory tone, the sort of don't do this, don't do that, push your chair in, ask to get down from table, is something that's really disappeared from schools. I'm just about old enough to have had that kind of education, but if you go into a school now, it's not about that. It's about self-expression. I mean, there are different philosophies of education within the whole sort of gamut of education, but it's very noticeable that schools place less emphasis on that kind of stuff, in the same way that, you know, I can remember being given scores for my handwriting when I was at school. And indeed, if it wasn't good, my work wasn't even examined. Again, I don't think that happens now because handwriting is seen as an expression of your unique personality, and to chastise someone for having what's considered to be poor handwriting is a kind of form of fascism or something in the eyes of sort of academic orthodoxy now. So there's been a big cultural shift there.
Can you talk, the book has a fascinating exploration of the evolution of this notion of chivalry, which today is such a sort of watered-down concept as compared with what it meant in its earliest iterations.
Yes, I mean, the word chivalry in its original sense meant, you know, the sort of practice of using a horse well and, you know, fine sort of horsemanship and kind of knightly deportment. I mean, it's a sort of 20th century cliche to say, oh, the age of chivalry is dead. And it's to the 19th century that we can trace back that notion that chivalry is to do with little courtesies, like sort of holding open doors. And that's to do with a kind of 19th century primarily literary, I'm thinking here of a British literary cult of the medieval period. So Walter Scott, probably at the time the most popular author, who sort of fetishized the medieval world and emphasized its little courtesies. But, you know, originally, chivalrousness meant sort of more of a kind of expertise. It wasn't about a veneer of ceremony. In the Middle Ages, chivalry was a serious code and a kind of vocation. It's probably originated in the 8th or 9th century at the court of Charlemagne in France. The word didn't actually sort of creep into English until about 1300. And essentially, it was the idea that it was a sort of professional discipline, actually, chivalry. It's not a sort of romantic thing. It's more like the techniques of behavior that are associated with being a knight, how to handle horses, how to kill animals, how to dissect and distribute their carcasses. And that probably all sounds quite visceral, but in that kind of society, getting that sort of stuff right was actually absolutely paramount, and getting it wrong could be immensely sort of dangerous and divisive. And things like tournaments, which we would probably now see again as sort of romantic opportunities for proving, you know, it's a bit like the Olympics or something. Actually, a medieval tournament was in part a means of preparing for warfare, and it was also a way of defining your reputation, a bit like putting your CV on the table now. It was a way of showing not just that you could sort of handle a horse, but that you were a kind of well-equipped individual. The sort of point, I suppose, is just that the whole concept of chivalry was originally something sort of highly technical and professional, rather than something sort of romantic and to do with relationships.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Paul in Garland. Hi, Paul.
Yes. Hi. Hey, Henry. I've got a question. Have you, in your studies or reading, seen any correlation between the English set of manners and the Confucian manners that were in the Chinese court? At one time in his writings, he said that he talked about the color and kind of hat to wear based on the time of season and who was in the court. Have you seen any corollaries with in your world?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm obviously familiar with what Confucius says, and, you know, as you say, there are guidelines on attire and on things like, yeah, the color of robes and things like that. I mean, what's interesting is that a lot of the principles that Confucius sets out are similar to those that obtain in the Western tradition, but they didn't influence it because Confucius was simply not known to English-speaking readers until comparatively recently. I couldn't give you the date for that. But, you know, the medieval codifiers of manners in Britain certainly wouldn't have read Confucius, although I suppose theoretically he would have been available to them. But what's interesting, in a way, about traditions of manners around the world is how similar they are. And that's why we then focus on the points of difference. And, you know, meal times are always one of the things where we notice the differences. You know, British tourists going to America notice the different way that cutlery gets used, the zigzag style of eating where the fork is passed from one hand to the other. It's really a very, very small thing. You know, we're all eating off plates, and we're all kind of having a meal in a particular order, and there are certain kind of principles about sharing things around and passing things. But we alight on the things which are points of differentiation. But actually, if you look at the Confucian codes or Islamic codes of conduct at mealtime, there's a lot of correlation between that and what we see in the sort of secular British tradition as well.
Is there a relationship between the customs that any particular culture has at mealtime and religious expression, or, you know, ways that are prescribed by different belief systems that explain the way that meals should be consumed?
I haven't really thought about it in those terms. I mean, can you sort of slightly shed some light on exactly what you mean there?
Well, I'm trying to think. You know, it becomes sort of very important in particular cultures to, you know, pour the tea at a certain time. And I'm thinking maybe of Asian cultures before you would serve a food item or something. And, of course, a perfect example doesn't come to mind right now. But there's a sort of ritualistic aspect to meals in
yeah.
particular cultures that becomes sort of part of etiquette.
Well, I suppose one of the ways I look at it is that the meal, whether you are religious or not, has the status of a kind of religious ritual. You know, there are very precise orders of service, which is a kind of, you know, an image where there's an analogy with what happens in church. There's usually a kind of hierarchy of seating, again, a bit like in church. There are times when silence is expected, again, perhaps a bit like in church. Meals have traditionally obviously been opportunities for communal celebration, for the coming together of a community. So they've had a lot in common with the way that in a church or other kind of religious institution, people sort of gather to participate in a shared act where there's a sense that some sort of higher power comes from their doing it together. And I think one of the things, you know, if we're going to talk about the decline of manners, which is something we hear about a lot, changes in the ways that we eat seem to be central to that. You know, the less communal eating, less formal eating, more eating on the hoof, the sort of TV dinner culture, microwave meals, rather than that sense of, you know, people coming together and having a participatory experience, which, you know, whether you're religious or secular, there's something about having a big meal with other people which has a kind of spiritual dimension. So I think there are parallels between meals and religious experience.
How did the term ladies and gentlemen become a very common form of addressing a group of individuals, sort of regardless of who those individuals might happen to be?
I can. This is a terrible, terrible answer, but I simply don't know, and I now suspect that you're going to tell me the answer.
No, actually, I was curious because you know, there's this idea that that, you know, at one point, you know, certainly in England, being a lady is something separate from being a woman, right? There's the implication of nobility.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because I think now the word lady is actually seen as rather sort of twee and patronizing in most situations, and a kind of hangover from possibly a sort of less democratic and egalitarian age. But of course, you're right that that traditionally, woman is seen as a slightly denigratory term, and lady as one that's sort of elevating. The phrase "ladies and gentlemen," I'm not really sure about the history of, and in fact, I feel rather guilty that I've never thought about it before. So I'm going to have to go away and find out about that. But that's, yeah, you've caught me on the hop.
We have an email here from Melissa who says, I can't stand being around individuals who focus on their phones rather than the people around them. It's like watching someone else speaking to themselves. I find it extremely disrespectful. Manners must be written around this apparatus. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a very interesting point that's raised there, because one of the things that I would say to anyone who says that manners are getting worse is that a big problem is we've got new things to have manners about, which we simply didn't have 15 or 20 years ago. And all these technological contraptions and phenomena of technology, like things like social media, throw up questions which have not yet been sort of satisfactorily resolved. And I suppose I see manners in the use of cell phones, manners in the use of social media websites, and all the other devices that one can imagine. It's a kind of work in progress, and I'd like to think that we're going to kind of move ahead with this. I was at a literary festival not that long ago, and someone raised essentially the same question about cell phones and how we were going to solve this. And I said that it wasn't a problem, because within 10 years, your cell phone will be inside your body rather than outside it. And I got a bit of a stunned silence when I was saying that. I mean, I'm not claiming that that's a very sort of utopian possibility, but I do think it's quite likely. But it's very striking that we haven't yet really worked out kind of, you know, what we should do with these devices.
Let me jump in here. We have to take another quick break. My guest is author Henry Hitchings. His new book is called Sorry, The English and Their Manners. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Henry Hitchings about his new book, Sorry, The English and Their Manners. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Henry, before the break, you were talking about the fact that our manners with new technology like cell phones are a work in progress.
Right, and I think it's fair to say that when you say the word bad manners, it's immediately the thing that comes up to a lot of people. I mean, it's interesting. I think we talk about bad manners more than good manners. And this is going back to a point that I made earlier about manners having an image problem. One of the problems, particularly where sort of young people are concerned, is that they hear a lot about what's wrong, but maybe not so much about what's right and what they ought to aspire to. But certainly when you say to people, you take a kind of straw poll, give me an example of an instance of bad manners. The thing that I find comes up is something about people using their cell phones inconsiderately. And it is simply, certainly an issue in Britain, is that we don't have kind of authoritative figures to say sensible things. I mean, I'm not suggesting there should be a sort of central manners academy, but at least in America, there are actually some kind of quite thoughtful, nuanced commentators on these matters. But I mean, you know, I'm sure if you did a sort of straw poll of your listeners, they would all have some horrendous story about people kind of abusing their cell phones. I have a friend who carries a book of poetry with her at all times, and if somebody starts using a cell phone in her presence, she gets her book of poetry out, starts reading it, and when the other person has terminated their conversation, she carries on reading it, and if they try and stop her, she puts her hand up and says, I've got to get to the end of my poem, which I think is a sort of weirdly archaic approach, but quite an endearing one at the same time.
I bet no one ever does that twice to her.
I think that's probably true, yes.
Well, talk a little bit about this. And your book is very specifically about the English and English manners. But, of course, the English-speaking world has long looked to England as sort of, if not the arbiter of these things, maybe the standard bearer. And there have been people throughout history who have come across the Atlantic and seen Americans and really thrown, wrung their hands in dismay at how crude and awful we were.
Well, I mean, it's true that that's happened. I find that sort of attitude pretty tedious. But, I mean, I suppose one of the best examples is Frances Trollope, who wrote a book called The Domestic Manners of the Americans, based on her experiences of living mainly in Cincinnati in, I suppose, the sort of 1820s, 1830s. And she had a pretty grim time and wrote this really sort of biting book, which was a big bestseller here and I think a big shocker to American readers. Although Mark Twain said that it was absolutely true in all its detail. Many people found it very offensive. She goes on the whole time about how much spitting there is and the terrible sort of familiarity of people who call her children honey and things like that. I mean, you might wonder why she gets quite so upset about it. There is this tradition of British people sneering at American manners, which I think is very misguided thing to do. I have to say, my experience is actually of American manners is that they tend to be better than British manners. I'm certainly very conscious when I'm in the U.S. that I cause offense by doing things that I could get away with in Britain very easily. So I don't have any sort of sense of superiority. But you are right that the British have been great exporters of their idea of manners. And actually something which is quite interesting at the moment is in China, there is a great appetite for not just British brands and British education, but also British etiquette experts. And I suppose in a society where lots of people are, in a matter of a generation, elevating themselves from pretty much peasants to the super rich, the sort of accoutrements of a patrician, rarefied lifestyle seem like nice things to have. So you have your wonderful collection of French wine and your wonderful collection of Italian or perhaps English tailoring, and then you have your English etiquette ideas, but what they're actually buying into is a rather outmoded and archaic, possibly rather charming idea of English etiquette, rather than something which they would actually find on the streets of London or Birmingham or Edinburgh, and actually they might be rather shocked if they materialized in Britain and found out what actually goes down here.
Henry, beyond, the essential elements of modesty, how did clothing start to be part of an expression of proper manners or proper etiquette, I should say?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I suppose one of the things to say about clothing, first of all, is that it's something we've got control over. You know, you can't really control what your body and your face look like, but you can control how you present yourself. And in a way, the way we react to people's sort of sartorial manners is a bit like the way we react to their table manners, except that people are dressed in our presence pretty much all the time, unless we're very, very lucky, whereas we only see them eating some of the time. But the thing about clothes is that they enable us to place people. Hmm. And that sort of notion of placing people, I think, is a very English thing, I have to say. The idea that one sort of looks at a person and makes, based on what they're wearing, a lot of assumptions about where they're from, the level of education they've got, even things like what their sort of moral standards might be. And there is this sort of tradition of linking aesthetics and morality and sort of looking for symmetry in dress because it's seen as a kind of mark of symmetry in personality. And that sense that there's a sort of balance to be struck between individuality and conformity, with the emphasis maybe tilting slightly towards conformity. I mean, nothing can get you in more trouble than being dressed in a way which is seen as sort of extreme. And the word appropriate always seems to be a word that comes up in the context, appropriate and inappropriate in the context of dress. And there are certain colors, for example, that can cause, offense. Purple was sort of traditionally a color only for emperors and popes and you know, bold character is often seen as being sort of signaled through bold color. The 18th century British politician Charles James Fox was famous for the fact that he wore blue hair powder and red-heeled shoes, and this was seen as a sort of mark of his being a real kind of political firebrand. And knowing about the associations of color and certain kind of styles that maybe sort of draw attention to our prized physical characteristics, etc., becomes a sort of part of our whole weapon. And there's a sense that there's a whole kind of, you know, psychology of clothes, and that clothes, I suppose you could say, enable us to kind of augment ourselves. They're like augmented reality. They create a kind of more favorable impression of what's there than what actually is there. But this sort of, it is a point worth making that even the most outrageous outfit probably causes less offense on average than the sight of a naked person in a public space. So there's a limit to how much kind of, you know, outrage you can cause with your clothes.
Why do you think that we always assume that the next generation coming up has and will continue to have far worse manners than the ones that have come before? Because, you know, you make the point that, you know, now children are sort of allowed to express themselves and they're maybe encouraged to do that more than to be very, very careful about their behavior around other people. But people have been complaining about children's manners for centuries.
Absolutely. I mean, as long as there's any documentation to do with this subject, people have been complaining about young people. I came across a 16th century pamphlet about everything that was wrong with society, which contained a section about how it was awful that there were men who played football and had long hair and wore earrings. And, you know, I had to check the date. It didn't look like 1579 to me. I think the reason, in answer to your original question, is that we're all, as we get older, instinctively nostalgists. There is always a perception that things were better. It's part of the sort of the kind of doomed nature of one's mortal existence, that as one gets older and becomes more aware of the kind of narrowing of time, so one's youth and everything about it acquires this sort of patina, or the rosy patina of halcyon days. And I just think it's kind of inevitable that one forms these kind of quite negative contrasts. It's a sort of talking point as well. You know, the conversation that goes, aren't young people lovely, is a very short conversation. But the conversation about the kind of depravities of youth is one that can be extended almost infinitely. And certainly that's something that sort of, you know, British people, when they're not talking about the weather, exult in.
Do you think that despite the way that particularly older guides to etiquette and manners were written, that we've always had the ability to understand intent and put more emphasis on that than maybe small errors in judgment?
I'd like to think that you were right about that, but I have to say I have so many experiences of being corrected for small errors which were made with good intentions, mm-hmm. that I do wonder about that. And I think one of the questions I'm interested in is it ruder to do the wrong thing or to point out to someone that they've done the wrong thing? Mm. And, you know, my book is historical and anthropological, but it's also anecdotal, and I have quite a lot of anecdotes about, you know, being put straight by people after committing what seemed to me to be a very trivial offense, and yet their intention in correcting me is something really, you know, far more sinister than anything I could have been doing. If I had my elbows on the table, you know, my intention at sort of worst was repose, probably. It wasn't like my intention was to sort of make the table collapse, but the person who upbraids you for that is expressing a sort of social one-upmanship, which seems to me to be kind of far more sinister. I'd like to think you were right, but I'm kind of concerned that actually sometimes this focus on the details sort of prevails over actually being able to understand people's intentions. But I think one of the reasons for that, and it's something that I see in common with language, actually, one of the reasons people argue about English usage so much is because it feels like it's something you can change. It feels like a battle you can win. But the fundamental problems of society can often feel intractable, certainly for the individual. And in the same way, I think picking up people on their manners or trying to sort of remedy people's manners or school their manners feels like a winnable battle, but actually reforming people's intentions is extremely difficult.
How have your travels in different parts of the world helped you to more fully understand how English you are in terms of your manners?
Well, I think probably my most interesting experience of this was going to Japan with 27 other young Europeans when I was in my 20s. First of all, because Japan is a country where manners really aren't optional,
right,
and there are very narrow and prescriptive standards about how you behave in lots of situations, and our hosts had constantly to explain to us what was going to be expected of us in terms of, you know, how we would proffer our business card and how we would wrap our gifts and how we should eat our food, which was kind of quite fascinating. But it was also very interesting to be in that melting pot of European nationalities and to see how one was perceived as an English person, because people were much more direct about it. I mean, if you travel, you definitely know that your nationality has a certain stereotype and certain perceptions abroad. But that was probably the first time in my life where people were really candid in my presence about what they thought of English people in a way that wasn't unpleasant, but was, you know, was quite sort of surprising to me. And the kind of recurrent theme is that actually the English are simultaneously very polite and very rude, and that's not a contradiction. The two things, it's almost like a kind of layer cake, and that one constantly sits on top of the other, and then there's a bit more of one, and then there's a bit more of the other. And there's this sort of constant oscillation between the two settings.
So you can't change one without fundamentally changing the other. You can't eliminate what is not good without destroying the part that is good?
No, I'm not. Well, I'm not actually sure that that's true. I suppose I'm talking more about perception than reality in terms of the layer cake.
Okay.
But I mean, I was just very, very struck by the fact that the sort of international notion of the polite English person is definitely there. But there's also this quite international notion of the sort of arrogant, aloof, repressed English person. And no one sees any kind of contradiction there.
The new book by author Henry Hitchings is called Sorry, The English and Their Manners. Henry, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you very much indeed for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.